Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Good day, everyone. I'm Andrea Mitchell in Washington with Katie Turr and Hallie Jackson in New York, bringing you the last investigative hearing of the January 6th committee before the midterms, with nearly 200 election-denying Republicans running for key positions across the nation. Today, we will see new surveillance footage from the Trump rally on the Ellipse and Secret Service documents proving how forcefully the former president tried to join the rioters on the Capitol at the 6th. The committee will show new evidence he planned to declare victory even before the election was held, and new testimony from top Trump cabinet members that they tried to stop him afterwards from overturning the results. Today's overriding theme, beyond Donald Trump, Congress and the voters have to work to preserve democracy as we know it.
Keep in mind, this is the first time in nearly 3 months that we're going to see the committee in action, right? And you know the political reality here. The House of Representatives could be in Republican control come January. So while committee members have repeatedly said they don't see these hearings as partisan, they've said that to all of us, there is still a political backdrop and a political context here, 26 days out from the midterms, and maybe even more importantly, ahead of a potential 2024 presidential run by Mr. Trump.
And there will be no live witnesses today, no live witnesses testifying during the hearing, keeping the spotlight instead on lawmakers, including Republicans Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, the two most prominent Trump adversaries within the former president's party. And they make a broad presentation on the efforts to overturn the election, Trump's state of mind before and during the insurrection, and what they believe are the ongoing threats to our democracy. And ladies, we've said this. We are 26 days out from the midterms. This is the committee making an urgent plea to the public that democracy is still under threat. Andrea, you said nearly 200 candidates out there, Republican candidates, right, denying the election. Well, it's almost 300 who are denying or questioning the election. That's for the House. It's for the Senate. It's for key positions in state legislatures. And they want to say that Donald Trump is still at the center of this all and that the public needs to pay attention. And I'll read this to you. Just over the weekend, Donald Trump was at a rally in Nevada, and he said, you know how he's into crowd sizes. He said, you know, the biggest crowd I ever saw, it was January 6th. It was the biggest, and they were largely there to protest a corrupt and rigged election. So he is continuing to spread this lie. And because there's been no awakening within him, and because the Republican Party has still embraced it, we are living to this day with the constant threats of another January 6th.
I think what you're saying is super important in the context of what we're about to see over the course of the next roughly 2.5 hours there on Capitol Hill, which is this. They have laid out over the course of 8 previous hearings what happened, the facts of the matter, what happened on January 6th. But here are the unpulled threads, if you will, that they haven't laid out, which are, what does this mean for the next election, right? For the midterms, for 2024, with Donald Trump mulling another presidential run, seeming likely to do that, right? And so I'm going to be watching for how do they make the case to the people who are watching that on January 6th, the guardrails for democracy were pretty fragile, right? And with the numbers that you've laid out here, Katie and Andrea, on the people who are denying elections, who are running for office, are they going to be eroded? Other unpulled threads. What about these lawmakers who have been subpoenaed, who are defying those subpoenas? What about anything having to do with former Vice President Mike Pence, right? It seems like some of that stuff has been put to bed, but a lot of it hasn't. And so I think that is part of what we're going to be looking for, Andrea, when this hearing gets started in about 55 minutes from now.
Exactly. And, you know, when we think about what the committee's purpose is, let's pull back a second and remind everyone that they are not prosecutors. And while they will turn over evidence potentially to the Justice Department, maybe make a referral, maybe not. That would have to be unanimous. Adam Schiff and Liz Cheney have both said. But In any case, their job is to lay out how the process needs to be preserved and what legislative remedies are required. So they're really recommending to Congress action, action that needs to be taken on election security beyond what has already been done in, you know, the House and Senate. And action to make sure at the local level that, for instance, how are legislatures, Republican state legislatures, going to respond? Right now, the Supreme Court is considering a case which would actually give state legislatures the right to overrule other officials and decide on the Electoral College. So there's so much at stake here. You know, when this committee wraps up, they're going to do an interim report and probably have another hearing, probably around that report after the election, and then a final report. And that document will be like the 9/11 Commission report, they hope, a book that is read, that becomes a bestseller, that becomes a fundamental, you know, document for democracy going forward. Let's begin to bring in our panel. A Washington Post congressional investigations reporter, Jackie Alemany, has broken so many stories about this committee and its work. And with us throughout the hearing, NBC Justice reporter Ryan Riley and NBC senior reporter Ben Collins. Jackie, first to you, because just in the last 24 hours, you and your Washington Post team have also broken new ground, not only on this, on Mar-a-Lago, but we also know from the New York Times that there is new evidence from the Secret Service that is really important, even though they don't have those texts from January 6th, which were under rather suspicious circumstances, somehow lost, erased, lost for all time. They've got, you know, thousands of documents, apparently, from the Secret Service since the last hearing, indicating, in fact, that the Secret Service was willing to go along with President Trump, according to the New York Times, but were stopped by the Metropolitan Police refusing to permit the motorcade to have clear sailing up to Capitol Hill on that very, very dangerous day. Jackie?
That's exactly right, Andrea. And actually, the committee has obtained over 1.5 million documents since the last hearing that the Department of Homeland Security handed over after the committee had essentially been having lots of issues with the Secret Service agency's cooperative posture and the lack of transparency. Lawmakers came to believe that the service was hiding items from them, hence them asking for and requesting text messages that were sent on January 6th, 5th, and 7th, before and after the insurrection, from some of the key players, people like Tony Ornato and Bobby Engel. Bobby Engel was the leader of the former president's Secret Service detail, and Tony Ornato was the head of the president's operations. They knew, they were very well aware and in touch with the president throughout the day and aware of his movements. But my colleague Carol Lenig and I reported on some of these emails specifically that were obtained in this latest tranche, some of which corroborate previous testimony that's already been provided by multiple witnesses, including the bombshell testimony of Cassidy Hutchinson, a former top aide to Mark Meadows. There are emails, Microsoft team chats, new radio frequencies, recordings of those conversations between Secret Service agents that we could be hearing today, along with surveillance footage that shows and lays out the violence that was taking place at the Ellipse during, before, and after the former president's speech, along with an email that was sent by a senior official in the Secret Service to Bobby Engel around 1:30, 2 p.m. on the day of January 6th, checking in with him to make sure that the president still wasn't planning to go to the Capitol because the former president was angry that he wasn't allowed to do so and continued to push to go despite knowing well knowing the violence that was going down at the Capitol during those hours.
You know, committee aides have said to our team there on Capitol Hill that they would not characterize this as a closing argument today, mm-hmm. right? Because of what Andrea has laid out, that there will be an interim report, a final report, et cetera. I imagine that part of what we will see today, Ben, is going to be the forward-looking piece of it, which is the argument that these threats are not over yet. You were reporting, gosh, I think we all talked to you in the holidays before January 6th, right, after the election, about your reporting on threats ahead of January 6th, back in the end of 2020, beginning of 2021, and you are still reporting on threats that exist today because of this, right? The foundational piece of this election fraud lie, including voter intimidation at drop boxes.
Yeah, so right now, the big thing with the pro-Trump media is to say, don't mail in your ballot. Vote on election day. because they think that there are mules everywhere. This is part of the Dinesh D'Souza sort of cinematic universe that they've created, where there is this cottage industry of building up this idea that drop boxes are being abused by Democrats to drop off thousands of ballots. And then what they do with those drop boxes, they watch those drop boxes like they're tailgating in the middle of the night. We saw this in Arizona a couple of months ago. So this lie does not just lay dormant. This lie that started January 6th affects our democracy in January 6th. It affects our democracy in perpetuity. And if you can't outlay why this is happening, that this is one guy's quest to unravel one election, then you're not going to have elections in the future that are untainted by this sort of intimidation.
It's a big job that the January 6th committee has to convince the public that the threat is still ongoing, as you've laid out, and the threat was there before. We went back and read some of the articles that you wrote in the days leading up to January 6th, the day before, where people told you that it feels very much with the chatter online like people are saying this is their last stand. So we saw it coming. And the committee is trying to say, as you said, that there is still that ongoing threat. It could come again. But there are so many people, Ben, that refuse to believe it. And part of that is because we're siloed. You know, you go to where you want to hear the information you want to hear. In your correspondence with the committee itself, what do they say about tackling that?
Well, a big thing for them is to reiterate over and over that this is its own world now, right? That, you know, Andrea just said there are 200 people running for statewide office that believe in this, that they are the Liz Cheney types in this space have been excommunicated from the party for the fact that they believe in the concept of democracy effectively, right? So they have to outlay this over and over again. This is not some sort of opinion. This is not some sort of political difference. That this was a violent attack that happened because a guy was trying to sell a lie to people in his base over and over again and created a new political party out of that thing.
Let's talk about the investigations going all around this, because obviously the legal case is just today. In the civil case, we had the New York State Attorney General, Letitia James, taking more action, claiming that the former president and his organization are still committing fraud on their finances and tax reports since her first actions, and wanting to freeze him from being able to move bank accounts to protect against any kind of outcome of disgorgement of the money down the road. I mean, there are so many cases. Fulton County, of course, the Georgia case, which is on hold right now in terms of any public explanation because of the proximity to the election. But that is directly on January 6th.
So yeah.
All of these cases, and now since the last hearing, of course, we know that Merrick Garland and the Justice Department, because of Mar-a-Lago, are very actively engaged in multiple grand juries.
Yeah, and I mean, the largest investigation in FBI history just into the people who actually stormed the U.S. Capitol. You know, we've had more than 870 at this point individuals charged, but in reality, that's only a fraction of the total spectrum of people who could eventually be arrested in connection with January 6th. There's about 2,700 who went inside the U.S. Capitol. Put on top of that, 300 plus people who still haven't been arrested, who assaulted law enforcement officers outside. So the spectrum of people you're talking about here is around 3,000. And unless they really step it up soon, they're going to be facing down that 5-year statute of limitations on a lot of these charges, because they're just not hitting the numbers that they need to on a week-to-week basis. That's something that DOJ, and we've been reporting out, DOJ has been pressing for more funding in the next budget cycle. But because of these continuing resolutions, they haven't gotten the funding quite yet that they really need to keep going with this operation. Because, you know, in a few months when the January 6th committee winds down, what's going to keep going is this Justice Department investigation, and whether that's going to touch on Trump as well as all of these thousands of individuals who entered the U.S. Capitol.
And, of course, the future of all of that could depend on what happens in the elections regarding who controls Congress,
yeah,
including appropriations for DOJ. Allie?
You know, Ryan, I want to ask you about some new reporting that you have out in just the last 2 or 3 minutes or so with our colleague Ken Delanian about an email that was sent with the subject line "Internal Concerns." A week after the January 6th attack, when a person you report familiar with the FBI operations told a top bureau manager that there's a sizable percentage of employee population that felt sympathetic to the people who were storming the Capitol. Tell us more about this, what this reporting shows, and anything else you can about where this goes from here.
You know, it's a really a lingering issue in this investigation because, frankly, there are just a lot of folks in the FBI for either political reasons or just other reasons that they aren't particularly interested in these January 6 cases. And a lot of people within the FBI had downplayed the threat that this really posed and compared it to a lot of other riots. And, what you know, it's just not an apples to apples comparison when you consider the storming of the U.S. Capitol, which is obviously federal property and is an FBI territory, that they would be in charge of any investigation into a storming of the U.S. Capitol, as opposed to some sort of investigation, say, you know, if a CVS gets ransacked in some city. That's not necessarily right. Something that is immediately going to draw the attention of the FBI. They can assist with those local investigations, but often in those investigations, the best charges to bring forward are state crimes. And in terms of the FBI investigation, the Capitol is, that's federal jurisdiction, right? There's no local prosecutor to bring those charges. That is, by definition, federal property and something that is directly within the control of the FBI. So, you know, this email essentially laid out some concerns directly after January 6th and some things that I've heard throughout my reporting on this investigation within the past year and a half plus about, you know, the internal politics of the FBI and how there just was a little bit of resistance in some of these field offices towards bringing these cases. And we've seen that with, you know, people come forward who are now making themselves out to be sort of these conservative whistleblowers within the Bureau. And one individual I'd point out that is who actually complained about a raid in Florida that, you know, got some positive coverage in the New York Post and in other places, saying that he was essentially this whistleblower, the FBI was overreaching. If you look into the details and you scratch the surface a little bit there, you realize the case that he was complaining about involved a militia. He didn't want to go ahead and arrest an individual who is associated with a militia that went to the U.S. Capitol on January 6th.
Ryan Riley, it's important reporting. Thank you so much. I know you and Ben Collins will be staying close for the next little bit. I appreciate it. Jackie Alemany, always great to see you as well. Thank you. Coming up here in our coverage, the best legal minds in the business joining us to break down the evidence we're expecting to see against the former president and a whole bunch of other investigations he's facing right now for our special coverage of the January 6th hearings on MSNBC.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations. And they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation.
In just about 40 minutes from now, the January 6th committee will gavel in its potentially final investigative hearing. I want to bring in now our panel, NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent Ali Vitali, who's posted up in her position, where she'll be for the next several hours. Chuck Rosenberg, former U.S. attorney, and senior FBI official Frank Figluzzi is with us, former assistant director for counterintelligence at the FBI. Joyce Vance, former U.S. attorney, and Yamiche Alcindor, NBC News Washington correspondent and moderator of Washington Week on PBS. And we should note, too, a little bit of breaking news just coming into us. Mark Short, former chief of staff to former Vice President Mike Pence, has just been spotted outside federal court in Washington. Ali, I want to start with you because you have been tip of the spear for us here at NBC News and MSNBC on what we will see from the hearing today. We know that there may be new information on, for example, that Roger Stone documentary that we reported on a couple of weeks ago. I know that Ginni Thomas's testimony was not videotaped. Is it possible we could see quotes, et cetera? Talk us through it.
Yeah, Hallie, that's definitely possible. One of the newest interviews that they have done was with Ginni Thomas during the intervening weeks that we've seen the committee stay out of the public eye, but still do a lot of investigating behind closed doors. You can hear around me, everyone is getting ready to go in for what we expect to be the last investigative hearing, the active laying out of the factual information that the committee has found. And in doing that, we're going to hear today a lot of the themes that we heard over the summer, each lawmaker on the committee going to be in charge of a different section of this roughly 2 to 2.5 hour hearing that we're about to begin. And in doing that, they're going to present some of the same themes, but with new evidence and information. You talked, for example, about that documentary featuring Roger Stone, effectively laying out the idea that Trump should say he won the election even before votes were cast, trying to establish what the mindset was around the former president. And in one member conversation that I had this morning, just trying to establish his intent. I'm glad the other prosecutors are on this panel because they can speak to the difficulties in trying to establish someone's intent, someone's mindset. But nonetheless, that's what this committee is trying to do and what one of their focuses has been throughout these hearings. But the other piece of this, too, is they're going to try to lay out the fact that this is still a present threat, not something that's just represented by Donald Trump, but as they turn to writing their final report, drafting concrete final recommendations, according to one member who I spoke to this morning, there's a lot of thought going into trying to shore up the larger small d Democratic system. Yes, this is about Trump in this moment, but also trying to push beyond him and ensure that a day like January 6th can never happen again or be taken advantage of by any other politician, including Donald Trump. And so there's the near-term argument that this committee has been making, but also trying to make sure that this is a threat that they still see as present and dangerous, but to also ensure that it never happens again.
Ali Vitale, Ali, thank you very much. I know you've got a lot to do today. Chuck, let's go back to what Hallie mentioned a moment ago. Mark Short at that federal courthouse in the grand jury room. There's also Kash Patel, the former Trump advisor, who was outside the same third floor grand jury room at that D.C. federal court. We have reason to believe this is part of the DOJ inquiry. What do you make of that?
Well, Katie, if in fact they've been subpoenaed to the grand jury, that's just an indication, more of an indication, that there's an ongoing and active criminal investigation. The reason you put witnesses in the grand jury, by the way, is to lock in their testimony. And that's really important for folks to understand. You don't have to put all of your witnesses in the grand jury. In fact, you don't have to put any of your witnesses in the grand jury. You can indict a case by having an FBI agent go in and she can tell the grand jury what she learned in her investigation. And that could be sufficient for an indictment. But the reason you put witnesses in a grand jury is that you take their testimony under oath. You ask them questions. They give you answers. There's a penalty if they lie. It's perjury or obstruction of justice. And moreover, if there ever is an indictment and a trial, and you call that particular person as a witness, and they deviate from the truth, they tell you some other story that they recently made up, or they claim to have forgotten what had happened, you can use that grand jury transcript in trial as a either to remind them what they had said, or as the or for the truth of the testimony itself. And so, prosecutors who are being cautious and who are being careful and who are being thorough like to put witnesses in a grand jury and lock down their testimony. And that's likely what you're seeing, or at least hearing about, right now.
In fact, let's talk about the Secret Service. There's new reporting today in the New York Times suggesting that the Secret Service would have gone along with Donald Trump to go up to Capitol Hill, but that the Metropolitan D.C. police stopped them from going there because they would not clear the way for a presidential motorcade, despite the fact that they were very well aware, and the president certainly knew from all the previous testimony, Cassidy Hutchinson and other people, that he knew that there were armed people going to the Hill.
Andrea, this is startling reporting. I mean, think about this. Think about the federal agents that protect the president of the United States being stopped by the local police department, saying it's too dangerous. You can't go. We can't clear this for you in a safe way. And ask the question, what if? What if the D.C. police acquiesced to a Secret Service request? What if the president, surrounded by heavily armed federal agents, proceeded to our Capitol, proceeded even to enter the Capitol with aided and abetted by armed Secret Service agents? This is a disaster narrowly averted. Would Secret Service have had to engage even in a violent or lethal force manner with citizens, with Capitol police officers protecting the Capitol? What would that have looked like. And so this is startling news. We also have Julia Ainslie from NBC reporting in the last couple of days that well over a million communications from throughout the Secret Service have gone to the committee for January 5 and January 6 throughout the Secret Service. So imagine what the committee now has access to, what they're learning from internal messaging, from emails that are in their possession about what higher ups were thinking and what rank and file were doing on the ground, preparing on January 5, what the threat level was, and then responding on January 6.
There's also the piece of this that relates to, obviously, it's the person who's at the center of all this, which is former President Trump, Yamiche. And I know that you are interested in something I'm interested in, which is what evidence might we see? The committee has said there will be new things that we haven't seen before that we will see today at the hearing. What evidence is there that perhaps directly ties the White House to people who were at the insurrection? I think we all remember when Denver Riggleman came out on 60 Minutes and said there was this call from the White House switchboard that connected to somebody who was at the insurrection on the day of the 6th. The committee since downplayed that. They sort of said, well, staffer, he's been gone for a long time. You know, if we had evidence, we'd be presumably putting it out there. Talk to me about how you see that fitting into the broader conversation that committee members will be having today.
I think it's a critical piece of this. What is the actual direct connection to former President Trump? I think we've heard all sorts of claims and we've heard people close to Trump say that he could not be convinced that he had lost this election. I want to see whether or not there's anything that says former President Trump was in direct contact with a number of the people that my friend Ryan Riley covers here. Is it the Proud Boys? Is it the Oath Keepers? Was there any sort of communication between the White House in real time with all of the things that were going on? We know that former President Trump did not try to stop this in real time, that he did not want to put out all of these different statements that people around him were saying. But I think clear that there still is this big question about former President Trump. And of course, we have to remember that former President Trump is someone who's going to be watching this along with us, right? So I'm sure just like you, Hallie, and everyone else, I'm going to be checking to see what he's saying about this, because part of his argument is this is a lot of circumstantial evidence, but they're not really here to directly tie me to this. So I think it's a critical question. As we know that this is the final hearing, at least that's what they say, the expectations are so high. And one of those expectations are, what else do you have on Trump?
Yeah. How do you directly tie it to Trump, and how close have they gotten to him up to this point? Joyce, what are your thoughts on that? This is the 10th hearing. How effective have they been at saying that this was all because of Donald Trump, and not just that, but that Donald Trump wanted this to happen?
The committee has been remarkably effective over time, alternatively surprising us, but also weaving together a narrative out of all of the facts. So their job today, Katie, I think is less about coming forward with new facts, although we hear that they will do some of that, but mostly their job is to remind us about how successful they've been in advancing the ball. Congress's role here, unlike DOJ's, isn't to convict anyone. Their role is to put together a fact finding so that the American people have an authoritative version of what occurred leading up to and on January 6th. Part of their job today will be to encourage us to understand the ongoing threat. The evidence that they've gathered suggests that the threat did not stop on January 6th, did not stop at the inauguration of Joe Biden. And so to Congress and on their shoulders falls the role of convincing Americans that this is an ongoing threat that needs to be taken seriously, and perhaps opening the conversation about what needs to be done next.
Chuck Rosenberg, Frank Figluzzi, Joyce Vance, and Yamiche Alcindor, everybody, thank you very much. And still ahead, former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson is going to join us for our special coverage of the January 6 hearings right here on MSNBC. Welcome back. We are about 30 minutes from the start of the 10th hearing from the January 6th committee. We now have eyes on the hearing room. There are people milling about. Nobody from the committee yet seated. We should see that right about at 1 o'clock, right before it begins. And we also expect to hear new evidence today regarding the texts and emails sent by the Secret Service on and around January 6th. And NBC News has exclusively reported agency leaders have seized not just work phones, but the personal phones of some agents. Joining us now is former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson. So let's start there. They have the work phones, Jay, but, you know, that had gone through a system-wide wipe, so they weren't able to get stuff from January 6th. Personal phones now, they're personal. What would be relevant to the committee? What would you might hear about?
Well, it sounds like the Secret Service, DHS, gave them a huge information dump of over 1 million different messages. What would be relevant for purposes of January 6th are any text, any communications back and forth between and among members of the president's protection detail, to learn the extent to which they took seriously his demand to go to the U.S. Capitol and what happened in the vehicle as he was getting back in and expected to go to the U.S. Capitol. But I've felt all along that from my experience with the Secret Service, back when I was a federal prosecutor, 1989, doing a counterfeit currency case with the Secret Service, I was told that these guys are good at the big stuff, but they're not good at the small stuff. They're not good at the paperwork. Basically, the Secret Service does no paperwork. And to me, the missing text are evidence of that. If you ask a member of a protection detail, and I was not only their oversight, but I was a protectee of the Secret Service for 3 years. If you ask a member of a protection detail who works very long hours, you have to, you know, stop and migrate the data on your phone to another device or personally do something with your own phone. That's probably going to go to the bottom of their list in terms of priorities, especially in the middle of a presidential transition in the wake of January 6th.
So do you believe it was less malicious and more negligent? Where do you stand on that spectrum?
I tend to believe that it was more in the nature of negligence. The Secret Service, to be blunt, has just never been good at the back office stuff. They can do things like orchestrate the security for the 2015 UN General Assembly that had 150 world leaders like the Pope and execute that flawlessly, but not pay adequate attention to a request that they save text on their personal devices. So that, it's unfortunate. I had to deal with a lot of unforced errors by the Secret Service when I was Secretary of DHS, but I can't say I'm that surprised.
Mm-hmm. Put that back in your ear because Andrea Mitchell is going to have a question for you.
Yeah, I can't hear anything in the ear. So.
Oh, okay. Well, hey, we'll stay here, Andrea, because he can't.
Jay, can you hear me now?
She's going to try.
Okay. Can you tell me what she's asking?
He cannot, Andrea. Let me, Andrea, text us the questions. We'll try to get him to Secretary Johnson.
Right, right.
Let me ask you about some of the reporting that we started off talking about at the top of the show here, which is coming from NBC News, that somebody familiar with the operations of the FBI said it told a top manager there were a sizable percentage of people, FBI employees, who felt sympathetic to the rioters at the Capitol. Can you tell us how you view the significance of that?
I saw that report, and if that is in fact true, that suggests to me that our vetting to be a Secret Service or an FBI agent or a federal law enforcement officer is not worth it.
Is it about vetting, though? Because half of the country or a good portion of the country believes in this lie, and partly because that it's been perpetuated by so many political leaders and so many voices that have amplification, wide amplification because of social media.
But Katie, a federal law enforcement officer should not be prone and susceptible to that kind of disinformation. And if someone in the FBI is, that says a lot to me about the vetting that should have occurred in the first place when they were walking in the door.
Jay, stay with us. We're going to be back in just a second. We want to continue this conversation. Again, we are just a few minutes away from the start of the January 6th committee. Again, that hearing room is open. We have eyes on it. We will go there as soon as it begins. And they are expected to outline the entire multi-step plan to overturn the 2020 election. What consequences can the major players expect as well? More from our special coverage straight ahead right here on MSNBC.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
I'm back with us now is Jay Johnson and our panel, of course, Hallie Jackson and Katie Turr in New York, first, and Chuck Rosenberg and Frank Figliuzzi and Joyce Vance. But Jay Johnson, I want to drill down on a couple of things. First of all, the Secret Service and the fact that they were willing to go up to the Hill. They are in touch, constant touch with the Secret Service people who are also protecting the vice president. They knew what the threat was. They knew that there were armed people at the Ellipse, and they're willing to take the president into that context, but were only stopped by the D.C. police. How does that happen?
The Secret Service is in the habit of planning for a number of different contingencies. If there was a thought of a possibility of taking the president to the U.S. Capitol, I would expect the Secret Service to have at least mapped it out, as deeply unwise as it would have been at the time. But it doesn't surprise me that there was some plan to do that in the event they got clear orders to do that. But it would appear from the evidence in the January 6th committee that they basically overruled the president on that.
Let me ask you about Cassidy Hutchinson. She's said under oath and testimony that Donald Trump was trying to force the Secret Service to take him there. Right. Does this new reporting by the Times help confirm that? Does it give you any more confidence in what she was saying?
Not sure, to be honest. It wouldn't surprise me that he really wanted to go to the Capitol. But this, you know, the report about him becoming very physical in the vehicle, that, according to Cass Hutchinson, that was like third-hand hearsay. We haven't heard directly from the head of his protection detail, and I suspect we won't.
Yeah.
And Jay Johnson, I also want to ask you about any possible criminal prosecutions of the president, because we've seen this fresh reporting, Franklin Foer interview with, of course, Merrick Garland, and conversations about what Merrick Garland may or may not do. And you, as a former prosecutor, have some views about the importance of January 6th vis-a-vis Mar-a-Lago in terms of issues before any prosecution.
So I'm sure Chuck and Joyce have views on this, too. First of all, it's going to be a very, very big and difficult decision for the Attorney General to make, probably the biggest one in my lifetime of any Attorney General. And there's always a temptation when you're in the prosecution seat to go for the quick and easy hit, you know, the Al Capone approach, get him on taxes. There's a provision in the Espionage Act that basically it says that if someone refuses a request to return sensitive national security information, that too is a criminal violation. The Justice Department could go that route and prosecute Trump for that and only that. In my judgment, if there's a case to be made for January 6th that President Trump incited the insurrection, I actually believe it's in the national interest that we call that what it is and not shy away from any such prosecution. And if we end up doing that, I think that the Department of Justice is going to have a very, very good explanation for why they're doing that, given all the evidence we now see from the January 6th committee.
All right, so what we're seeing right now is Chairman Benny Thompson speaking to reporters ahead of this hearing. I don't believe we have a microphone in that gaggle. We do not, but we will figure out what he said and we will bring it to you. We also, again, have more from that reporting from the top of the hour from NBC News, from Ryan Riley and Ken Delaney. And I know, Ryan, you're with us. We now have the actual email that was sent to the FBI concerned about who was within the ranks. And it goes into some detail about this person's concern that there's a sizable percentage of the employee population that felt sympathetic to the group that stormed the Capitol and said it was no different than the Black Lives Matter protests of last summer. They talked about political correctness. This person says he literally had to explain to an agent the difference between Black Lives Matter protesters and the organized mob that stormed the Capitol. Also talked about how he had spoken, I presume it's a he had spoken, might be a she, spoken to multiple African-American agents who have turned down asks to join SWAT teams because they do not trust that every member of their office's SWAT team would protect them in an armed conflict. That's scary. Talking about how at one office, all of the TVs in that squad's office were turned to far-right media channels like Newsmax. Those TVs were previously tuned to Fox News, but post-election, the group found that Fox News was, quote, playing to the left and reporting fake news. And at the time, we'll remember that Fox News's ratings did plummet quite a bit because they called the election for Joe Biden. And at the time, Newsmax's ratings had started to rise. It's since they bottomed out and Fox News has reigned once again as Fox has taken on the questions surrounding the 2020 election, as Newsmax had been doing. Ryan, this letter is, you know, it's scary if you believe in democracy.
Yeah, you know, it is definitely concerning. I mean, we should note that there are a lot of folks at the FBI who are doing their jobs, even if their political beliefs don't necessarily, you know, if their political beliefs generally align with Republicans or conservatives, which is a lot of the FBI. You know, it does often get lost, I think, in the past 6 years since really Donald Trump entered onto the scene, that the FBI is a conservative-leaning law enforcement organization because we've seen so many attacks on it and portrayal of the FBI as some sort of liberal bastion. But, you know, in reality, if you just look in at the groups that feed into the FBI, the demographics of the FBI, and, you know, folks who typically go into law enforcement, it's more of a conservative-leaning organization. So it is scary when you have folks who did get sucked into some of the conspiracy theories or don't recognize that an attack on the U.S. Capitol, the seat of democracy, is a lot different from, you know, just your sort of run-of-the-mill riot in a lot of locations, and why, you know, by necessity, in fact, the FBI has to be at the forefront of this investigation. It's the largest, you know, domestic terrorism investigation in FBI history, if you talk about the number of defendants. But this is definitely, over the course of the past year and a half plus, something that's come up and it's been this sort of lingering issue, as I've been reporting on a lot of the fallout from the Capitol attack, is that, you know, there are folks within the FBI who don't see this as serious of as an issue as it is.
And as we see, the hearing room is beginning to fill up. We see some of the police officers, Officer Fanone, some of the others who were injured, who suffered and have testified about it, and also testified in the Oath Keepers case and in some of the other cases that have come up, as well as the parents of the Sitnik and some of the other officers who did not survive January 6th. Frank Figlusi, I know you, as a former FBI man, wrote the book on the FBI and how the FBI works. But there, in any organization, there are problems, and there are those who follow their political instincts rather than their duty.
Indeed, that's true. In fact, my last column for MSNBC Daily addressed this issue of so-called FBI whistleblowers. I say so-called because they seem to be running to members of Congress that are really in the Trump camp, Jim Jordan, Ron Jones, et cetera, instead of perhaps going through the proper protocols. But here's my read on this. First, as Ken Delanian has pointed out in his reporting, this email is marked external. So it came from outside the FBI, yet it's someone claiming they've had access broadly across FBI field offices and access to employees. So running through that in my mind, it's possible that this is coming from the Retired Agents Association, or it's coming from the Active Agents Association. And that's interesting, but it also smacks of having a political agenda. You know, if an FBI employee can't understand the difference between Black Lives Matter violence and an attempt to overthrow the government and stop a valid election, then they need to find another job. That's the way that goes. There's about, I don't know, 38,000 employees in the FBI. If a handful of them, and reportedly, according to Jim Jordan, 13 or 14 employees have come to him complaining about domestic terrorism strategy. If that's it, then okay, I get it. But the notion is disturbing. If the FBI, the agency that has to ferret out violent extremism and terrorism in our society, also has to look within its own hallways to make sure that that violent extremism doesn't exist there, then that's a distraction they don't need, and it's something we need to keep an eye on.
Well, my question would be then, after getting this letter, did the FBI go around and try to figure out and ferret out, as you said, Frank, the agents that couldn't tell the difference between Black Lives Matter protests and those who stormed the Capitol. Is there that active effort going on right now to make sure, Chuck, that the FBI is full of people who understand the law and are not politically motivated? Chuck Rosenberg's not with us for that. Joyce, what do you think?
Well, I think this is one of the most important jobs that Director Wray faces. The Bureau has been through an extremely difficult time. The Trump era was not an era that anyone in law enforcement had expected from the type of administration that's typically very supportive of law enforcement. And then on top of that, you have everything that happens around January 6th, which was incredibly divisive in the country. No surprise that it would be divisive inside of the Bureau and other federal law enforcement agencies as well. But I think Frank makes the most important point here, which is that if there were agents who were unable to set aside whatever sorts of information they had been unable to filter out, anyone who had gone down the primrose path with some of the Proud Boys or other sorts of groups, and people who were unable to fulfill their oath to ferret out people who violated the law, then the leadership at the FBI had an obligation to see that those people were no longer a part of federal law enforcement. That's a tough job. I don't mean to make light of it in any way. It's an enormous responsibility, but it falls on Chris Wray's shoulders, and he's ideally situated to carry forward with it. He's not a career FBI agent. He's someone who came out of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Atlanta. He was an official in the criminal division during the Bush administration. He's the Trump appointee at the FBI, so he is someone who cannot be accused of acting out of political motivation if he undertakes the very serious internal look that the FBI needs to have at itself.
Jay.
Looking at this letter now, I think I can honestly say my reaction, if I were Secretary of DHS, which is the largest federal cabinet department of civilian gun carriers we have, if I had received something like this about my own workforce, I would have delivered a very stern message to the agency. Look, there is no equivalency between an armed insurrection on the U.S. Capitol and a Black Lives Matter protest. An armed insurrection is a once-in-a-century
event. By the way, the Black Lives Matter protests, let us be clear, were largely peaceful. They were done during the day. They were largely peaceful. Let's not forget that. I don't want to equivocate on violence. I know you're not doing that, sir. But when it turned tonight and there were bad actors involved, some of them not even with Black Lives Matter, some of them instigators, as was later revealed, that's when things got ugly. So I just do want to be
correct.
I was in a lot of those protests. They were peaceful.
There is no equivalency between the two. And if you believe that, you need to leave and leave your gun and your badge at the front desk on the way out. That would be my message.
Joining us now is Andrew Weissman, former FBI general counsel. Andrew, let's talk about, you know, the whole difference between what this committee is doing, which is to present evidence, present information to educate the public, but not to prosecute. And the other piece of it, which is that there's a lot that's going on around us, around all of these issues. Jay Johnson, just before you joined us, was talking about how he would focus on any potential prosecution of Donald Trump, given the importance and how unprecedented that would be on January 6th, on the insurrection. And not on the Mar-a-Lago National Archives issues, which are perhaps easier to prosecute but smaller significance. What is your take?
Well, the one thing that I would maybe quibble with is the Mar-a-Lago case is actually of significance from a national security perspective. And I think people like Jay and I, when we were in the government, would have sounded the alarm in the way that Merrick Garland and Lisa Monaco, the Attorney General and Deputy Attorney General, have on Mar-a-Lago because of the real significance to national security interests. So although it is a smaller and easier case, it is of true importance, at least at the national security level. But turning to the January 6th case, you know, there's two levels in which this hearing's happening. One is sort of a political level. That's not something that's in my beat. But I listen to it from a second level, which is what kind of evidence is coming out of this that could help or hurt with respect to a potential criminal case against Donald Trump or others. So I'm going to be really listening to evidence that goes to criminal intent. Is there evidence, sort of direct evidence or strong circumstantial evidence of what Donald Trump was trying to do? And I think the beauty and the real gift of the January 6th committee is looking at the activities holistically. And what I mean by that is not just looking, although we call it the January 6th committee, that's kind of a misnomer, because one of the things they've really done is pulled back from that day to talk about what led to that and all of the different efforts that the White House was involved in that they were trying to use to overthrow the will of the people. So that's what I'm going to be listening for, is that kind of proof that a prosecutor would be able to use in a criminal case.
Andrew, I know this is not a closing argument. The committee has said so, but they have said that this is probably going to be the last investigative hearing. We've had 10 so far. We've learned so much. There have been so many revelations, so many bombshells. How do they take all of that information and start to synthesize it for just 2.5 hours, which is how long we expect this to be, in a way that will be most effective, as they want it to be, effective in convincing the public of what is at stake here, the threat that is ongoing to our elections?
Well, it may be more difficult in that they don't have witnesses, but they do have, they have that documentary, the Danish documentary, so new evidence about Roger Stone and his role and some of the extremist groups. So they've got new video, they've got new testimony from the cabinet secretaries, and we can bet that there'll be something about Ginni Thomas, because they interviewed her, she wasn't on camera, but that is the wife of a Supreme Court justice, the most senior Supreme Court justice, the only dissenter on a key case involving former President Trump. And Katie, as you know so well, she has been a political activist for being among the election deniers wanting to overturn the election in a number of those key battleground states, and pressing Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, pressing others in the White House, as well as in the inner circle of Donald Trump, to take some action.
About the danger of that day and what might have happened had things gotten more out of hand. We learned, you know, in the moments of the insurrection, as we were watching it, Andrea, live on television, as it was unfolding in front of us, we heard the chants of hang Mike Pence. And those have figured pretty prominently within these hearings. Are we going to get more about those chants and how folks around Pence responded? Any more about how Donald Trump did or did not respond? We're going to get a little bit of new information today. I wonder if that's going to be part of it. Before we go into this committee hearing, which is going to start any minute now, we are 1 minute away from the top of the hour when it's set to begin. I do wonder, just in terms of buttoning it up, of getting it all out there, as we're 26 days until the next election, how are we feeling about whether this has been effective in the public sphere? And again, does that matter?
Well, I think it does matter to the committee members, because they are very intent on being persuasive, on creating that document. And we'll have to see what their interim and their final reports show. But I think one big unanswered question is going to be Mike Pence, because he said he might cooperate, but has not yet. He has not been interviewed. He has not been videotaped, although his top aides have. And he has obviously ambitions and would be a competitor in 2024. So we're, you know, only, you know, a month away from this midterm, but we are a month and a year away from the most consequential election, which is the next presidential election, Katie. And as we prepare and we see that front row of the police, Metropolitan and Capitol Police officers, some of whom were injured, many of whom we've interviewed over these years and we've, you know, talked to since January 6th, about their continuing mental anguish and the effects on them, leaving the force in one case, because they could not continue in the force because of all the harassment that they felt. So looking at the door, Katie, and I think as the door opens, you're going to see Benny Thompson and Liz Cheney coming in. And that's the other piece. There's Benny Thompson and Liz Cheney. That big difference, which is that since Liz Cheney's last hearing, she has run for renomination and lost in the primary and is now not running for election. And this is going to be this and the subsequent hearings around the interim and final report, most likely. This is her last platform in this venue before she ends up leaving Congress. And then the big question, Katie, is what happens to all the evidence they've gathered? Will it be turned over to the Justice Department? That would require, or referral will at least require for prosecution, require a unanimous vote. We're not clear that they have that yet. Katie?
Looks like Chairman Benny Thompson is about to gavel in. He has reached for it, so let us go in.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.